open the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Human Resources. Here again from the Department, I mean the Health Division. And Eleanor, maybe you want to introduce, either you handle it or somebody is going to.
Yes. If you, thank you. Good morning.
Good afternoon already.
Yeah. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Eleanor Hall. I'm the Oregon Health Division. I'm the administrator. And we thought we would work directly off of your budget books today since we only have a few slides remaining. So allow us to keep the curtains open and move right along. So I think you could start on page 31 of your budget book. The slides of the book that I brought. I was going to talk briefly about the fact that there are a number of voter-approved initiatives that have impacted the health division. I'm going to then pretty quickly move into talking about our maternal and child health programs, then provide you some information that follow up to testimony you heard on Thursday, as well as some of the questions you raised about fluoride, diabetes, other issues that were talked about that we said we would get you some more information on. Then we would have a DAS staff summary and then do our fee bill 5030. So we have
okay.
A lot of things
good
to try to cover. And, okay. We did have some voter-approved initiatives that have impacted the health division in the last few years. The Death with Dignity ballot measure finds the health division record-keeping and reporting functions, and there are no funds attached. And, in fact, the health division has spent quite a lot of time having to adopt rules and provide studies and try to, provide some level of oversight on this ballot measure. Measure 44 also gave the health division major responsibility for a program. This was the tobacco tax, and you've heard about the program that was created within the health division by Measure 44. And in 1998, two bills passed, which again gave jobs to the health division. The medical marijuana bill requires the health division to register people for using marijuana for medical purposes. And we are to adopt rules. We have an administrative rules hearing scheduled for April 15th, with the actual registration cards scheduled to begin May 1st. And we're allowed to charge fees for the registration cards, but there were no upfront fees or no upfront money to compensate us for the work we've been doing on trying to establish the administrative rules or develop this process. And I do want to alert you to the fact that at this point we think our fee will be between $150 and $200 a year per person, depending on how many total people end up registering for medical marijuana. This is significantly higher than the proponents of the bill had envisioned, and in fact may represent a barrier for some people who are on a lower fixed income. You may be hearing about this in your capacity as allocating general funds, but we at this point are trying to set the fee to cover our costs, and when we envision a fairly small number of registrants, our costs are fairly high.
Eleanor, can you tell us what the health division's role is in certifying marijuana as usable, or where someone who qualifies and gets this license actually acquires the product?
Senator Tucup and Representative Strobeck, the issue of where they would acquire the product is certainly beyond our help, and we've had a number of people calling us and saying they are registering and sending us material, but where can they get marijuana legally? And we tell them that we really can't help them. They can possess it under this statute, but it's still illegal for them to buy it. The health division is supposed to provide information to law enforcement. We're supposed to have a process for adding new medical conditions which could benefit from the use of marijuana, which we assume we will be petitioned to add those conditions and probably have to set up some kind of a review panel. We're supposed to define mature plants in the rules because people are allowed to have so many mature plants in their possession. So we have this fairly elaborate rule process. We're also supposed to verify certain information that people submit to us. And certainly one of the questions for us is, what does the term verify mean in the context of this statute? Do we do spot checks? Do we check every single application? Do we get a letter from a physician? Do we assume the physician sent it, and so on? So it's something we're feeling our way on, and the rules that we're proposing do address many of these issues.
And what is the implementation date or the effective date of the program?
Here, Representative Strobeck, May 1st is the date when people are supposed to be able to submit their applications for cards. However, they were able to use this as a defense 3 days after the election was certified, which I believe was in early December. The Adopt These List Certificate was another ballot measure that is effective in the Health Division. This would require the Health Division to provide additional birth certificates to adoptees. Currently, we're not implementing this ballot measure because there is a court case going on to determine whether the statute would violate previous contracts and privacy of mothers who give their babies up for adoption. However, if the law is implemented, the Health Division would need to engage in a process where we take the birth certificate that was issued to the adoptee, which now has their adoptive parents as their birth parents, and trace that back to a record that's been sealed and probably archived, and provide that information to the adult who's requesting it. And people could be requesting this information from all over the United States, certainly children that were given up, were born in Oregon, may be living all around the country. And we have been communicating with the Attorney General about how we would be able to modify this statute if the court were to require some modifications. And I know there's a bill that's been drafted here in the legislature to modify the legislation. We, of course, on all of these ballot measures, were neutral, as the law requires us to be, and are just trying to carry out the will of the voters. Turning to the next page, I wanted to talk a little bit about the many partnerships that are involved in being a public health agency in the state. Here you see the names of the divisions in the Department of Human Resources, and with each one of these divisions, we have a series of partnerships and programs and goals in common. In a sort of general way, our relationship to these other departments falls into three categories. We provide services to some of the same people that they provide services to. So, for instance, there is some overlap between the TANF caseload and families that are in our WIC program. There is some overlap between people who are in the Office of Medical Assistance and people who need public health services. So we provide services to some of the same clients. Then we also provide services that will keep people from falling into these caseloads. If our projects to prevent injury are successful, we may have fewer people who are needing vocational rehabilitation. We will prevent the disability before it becomes a major government cost. If our projects on chronic disease are successful, we may have fewer people who need senior and disabled services when they age. They may be healthy, more independent adults because they received the right kind of preventive services when they were younger, in their 50s, for example. But we do have services that we provide which ought to prevent people from coming into these caseload-driven services. If our prevention and education and systems are successful, we will save the department and the state from having as high a caseload. And then thirdly, we provide data and information, which I think is useful to the other divisions, information around what is happening to our youth. This Youth Behavior Risk Survey, for instance, gives the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse important information about what kids think and do around alcohol and drugs. Our Adult Youth Behavior Survey gives information to mental health about people's need for services. So we provide vital statistics and survey data, which helps all of the division's programs. We also have a lot of partners with other departments in the state. And if you turn to page 33, I've tried to list some of those partnerships. And I'm not going to read you every one of these, but as you look across them, you can see that the Health Division has connections with education. There's a lot of projects we want to do to help our students and young people be healthy. We have connections to law enforcement. with the state police and regulation and Department of Consumer and Business Affairs. We certainly do work with the Department of Environmental Quality. The issues of the environment in this state are fairly dispersed, with some environmental issues happening in Department of Environmental Quality, some in the Health Division, some in Department of Ag, and so on. So part of our job here is to provide information to these divisions about how they, their programs affect human health and to work with them on meeting their goals and objectives. For those of you who just came in recently, we're on page 33 of the big book.
I really love the graph you have on page 33 that explains your relationship with other departments. Do you have a similar graph that would just explain your relationship? I know that you just have two listing, WIC and CANA, for Adult and Family Services, on page 32. Do you have a similar diagram?
Yes, we do.
Maybe we should already know all of that and should know every relationship, but if we had kind of an expanded thing on page 32, similar to what you do on 33, I think it would be helpful, at least to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you were just talking about, you know, chronic disease is one place where you work between the Health Division and Senior and Disabled Services. There's probably more. And if you just went around that same circle, that would help me a lot.
And if you have any committee members, I'd be very glad to follow up and give you a graph that mentions those things, or if you'd like, I could go around the circle.
It doesn't matter to me. It's up to the chair.
Well,
actually, if you could provide what you have on 33, on 32, I'd like that too. So it is so that we don't, I mean, we could take notes now, and that's good too, but I think it would be good for future reference as well, if you can do that.
We'd be delighted to do that.
Okay.
We feel that there's lots of areas where we do need to work closely together and work in alignment towards common goals, and I'd be delighted to share that information with you. So I think this chart of the Oregon Health Division and other state governments really kind of illustrates the fact that although you have a public health division, public health is a lot broader than that. It's something that is done throughout society and throughout lots of parts of our government in terms of trying to achieve a healthy community and a healthy population. Turning to page 34, I'd like to begin talking a little bit about one set of our programs that we call the Maternal and Child Health Program. And we really have, as you know, a lot of programs, many, many programs, too many probably to talk about each program for an extended length of time. So I chose to focus some presentations on maternal and child health and then also on tobacco. And we've already done our tobacco presentation. So this will, this section on maternal and child health will conclude my presentation on the Health Division budget. I know that the legislature is very interested in funding education adequately and is very aware of the importance of education to the future of the state. And we all are concerned about how to get the best future for our children and how to invest our money most wisely so that our children are prepared to carry on the responsibilities of adults, carry on the future for our state. One of the points I wanted to try to make today was how maternal and child health programs work to help create the kind of outcomes that we really want to see for children. In the long run, I think that maternal and child health programs are an important complement to education and are part of what will enable us to get the results we want from education. So I did a little stair-step graph here saying that in the beginning we want babies to be born healthy. If babies are not born healthy, if they're not born neurologically intact, we can spend millions of dollars on special education and potentially still not have children that are equipped to become healthy, productive adults. This birth period, a few months before birth and the months during pregnancy are incredibly critical to a child's ultimate functioning in society. There are many causes of birth defects, retardation, developmental delays, things that happen during this period of time where if we are working with a mother, if she's getting the right prenatal care and so on, we can change the outcome for a child. Once we get them born healthy, we want them to arrive at kindergarten ready to learn. Then we know healthy kids make better students, and ultimately healthy adolescents are prepared to become independent, productive adults. And I'm going to take each one of these little stair steps and just talk a little bit about what public health does in each area. So turning the page, we see babies are born healthy. There are some things we want mothers not to do, and that's on the right-hand side, no smoke, no drink. Cigarette smoking causes 25% of low birth weight babies. Low birth weight is the leading cause of mental retardation. Just think, we could have smarter kids if fewer moms smoked. That's where the fact that 1,000 fewer mothers smoked during their pregnancy in the last year makes us very hopeful for the future of kids. No alcohol. Alcohol is also a leading cause of birth defects and a leading cause of mental retardation. You're probably familiar with fetal alcohol syndrome, which is the most drastic form of birth problems caused by alcohol. But there's plenty of also children who are just affected, fetal affected by alcohol. And often those symptoms are subtler and more difficult to determine, but they involve children who have learning disabilities, who have pervasive developmental disabilities, who are unable to function in the classroom. And again, that brief window of time when their mother is pregnant can make a huge difference in how the baby's born. And on the left-hand side are things we want the mother to do. We want good nutrition, the right kind of, plenty of calories and the right kind of calories. There's early prenatal care and education can support good nutrition. Prenatal case management can help support all of these other items that we're saying are important for babies being born healthy. We currently are working to let all women of childbearing age know the importance of folic acid. If women get enough folic acid before and during the early parts of their pregnancy, we can prevent up to 50% of neural tube defects. Neural tube defects are the general name for things like spina bifida, which can cause paralysis, retardation, tremendous complex physical problems for a child whose spinal cord doesn't close. And just think, a little bit of enriched cereal or a vitamin can prevent that terrible birth defect. When we promote healthy birth weight, again, we're promoting...
Is there a common name for folic acid? What is that?
Well, it's a B vitamin, and on vitamin pills, it's called folic acid. And right now, cereals and bread products are being enriched with folic acid to try to make sure that people get enough of it.
It is vitamin B?
It is a vitamin B.
Oh, mm-hmm.
One of the problems is that usually by the time women realize they're pregnant, that critical window has passed for getting enough folic acid. So we really have to reach women of childbearing age and talk to them about the fact that if they hope to have a baby, it's important to start getting enough folic acid even before they become pregnant. So it's a little more complicated than giving them the prenatal vitamins when they're 3 months pregnant. But we are seeing some decrease in neural tube defects in part, I believe, due to this cereal enrichment, enrichment of breakfast cereal that's going on. Promoting a healthy birth weight is an important part of prenatal care and an important part of prenatal case management. We know that intended pregnancies, where the mother and father want to have this baby, tend to have a better chance of having all these things happen. That women are more likely to get early prenatal care, they're more likely to stop drinking and smoking, they're planning and wanting this baby as opposed to finding out halfway through that something's happening they want to deny. It's important to test women for communicable diseases, for STDs or HIV, and to protect them from communicable diseases such as measles, which, as you know, have tragically caused terrible infant birth anomalies. A safe home environment is also important. We don't want a pregnant woman exposed to environmental toxins, either at work or in her home, or exposed to domestic violence, which can also cause problems for the mother and healthy birth.
Before we turn the page, you've given folic acid and vitamins as a good preventive thing to reduce the the neural tube defect in babies. I'm wondering what kind of programs or whatever do you have that help to prevent unintended pregnancies?
Well, we have a variety of programs. Yeah, I think that our family planning program is probably our most direct effort to prevent unintended pregnancies. And this is family planning clinics that are run by county health departments for the most part, with a combination of state and federal funds, and also they have sliding fee scales for people who can pay some. And those clinics provide pregnancy testing, family planning methods, education about family planning, counseling to a person about what their choices are around methods. Do they want to take pills? Do they want IUDs and or plants? That's the most direct kind of service we provide. And often we'll see people who come into those clinics with a negative pregnancy test, and one of our goals is to help them realize that if they don't want to be pregnant, what are they going to do about it? And we serve men and women all over the state through these clinics. I do think that our STARS program in sixth and seventh graders is also a program. Our whole teen pregnancy prevention program is an attempt to prevent unintended pregnancy. And the teen pregnancy prevention program is much bigger than just the family planning program. There's the STARS program, which is an abstinence-only program, and we'll talk more about that because I do want to provide you some more information about what STARS does and is. There's efforts to change community norms and values, including involving parents and more community institutions, more life skills education for kids so they feel that they have a future, especially kids who are at risk and not doing well in school need to feel they have opportunities, and also some guidance about making good choices. We have efforts to reduce predatory behavior by older men who are concerned that too often the parents, the father of a teen birth is a much older man. So the teen pregnancy prevention agenda, I think, is intended to prevent some of the highest risk unintended pregnancies. But it's unintended pregnancy is certainly a problem throughout the age span. And in fact, it's very surprising but true that women in their 40s have about the same unintended pregnancy rate as teenagers do. It's a time when a lot of women aren't thinking they can get pregnant, and they do. So unintended pregnancy is not simply a problem of young people. It is a problem that exists throughout our community. And we have seen data from other states that estimate that about 40% of all pregnancies at all ages, all income levels, all levels of education are unintended. So just helping people do what they want themselves can make a big dent in a lot of these issues.
I think some people, when you say unintended, too, sometimes think unwanted, and that is not necessarily the case when a pregnancy is unintended. And in fact, I've looked at studies that show that even in cases where there was an unintended pregnancy and it began as an unwanted pregnancy, over a period of months, that attitude changed and became a wanted pregnancy. So that is a way, too, that I could see health departments aiding if somebody comes for counseling, that they do counsel them along those lines, too, because studies actually have shown that where they follow women who didn't intend to be pregnant but became pregnant. And then later it turned from an unwanted to a wanted pregnancy.
That is certainly true. Well, if we've got our babies born healthy, I think that is a really important thing, that if we got more babies born healthy, we would have more kids coming to kindergarten, we would have more healthy kids coming into kindergarten. But before we can get there, we show on channel on page 36. We have a new campaign to watch this. Well, the early years.
they're ready for kindergarten, and they're still little toddlers. There's still a lot of health and safety issues.
One of the health division's program is metabolic screenings for all newborns. Now, these are the newborn screening program that our public health lab performs, where they test to see if the baby has been born with inborn metabolic errors, such as PKU or sickle cell anemia. We test for almost, I believe it's almost 40 things. Maybe that's too high. We test for a lot of different inborn metabolic errors and can notify pediatricians and families in the first few weeks of the baby's life whether they're going to need special care and special services to help them grow up normally. PKU used to cause mental retardation that had people living in Fairview for their entire lives. And people who've worked in Fairview for a long time remember when young adolescents would come into Fairview. Now, because of PKU testing, children who have this inborn metabolic error can have a special diet that prevents brain damage and allows them to grow up to be absolutely intelligent, productive, normal human beings. So it's a wonderful example of how this little test can really salvage lives and save a tremendous amount of cost. The Back to Sleep campaign is designed to help keep fewer children.
I may have been on the phone. Did you say PKU?
I did.
Dr.
Seals. Either one of you. Feel free to ask, but I can't pronounce them quite
enough. Let me do it.
Naturally.
Chairman Q-Tub, for the record, I'm Mike Seals. I'm the director of the State Public Health Lab. Representative Loken, PKU stands for phenylketonuria, which means that one of the amino acids that's a normal part of body chemistry is present in too high an amount in the baby's blood. And if you don't detect that, and as Eleanor said, modify the diet so that the amino acid doesn't reach those critical levels while the brain is developing, then there can be brain damage. That's one of the tests that we test for, one of the disorders. The most common one is hypothyroidism, which is present in about one in 3,500 live births. The child is born without a thyroid gland that functions at all, and if those children are not detected, they become what we used to call cretins. They had an IQ of about 40 and had very short stature. And so about one in roughly 3,300 or 3,400 babies born in Oregon have one or more, or at least one of these disorders.
How long have you done the PKU testing? Is that relatively recent or?
Representative Loken, Oregon was the first state in the United States to begin statewide PKU testing, and that was done in the middle 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had this program in place for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Been very well received, very successful.
Thank you. Sudden infant death syndrome are words that strike terror into most new parents' hearts. And to lose a perfectly healthy infant to no known cause with no known prevention has been one of the most frustrating things for pediatricians and people who work with young families to face. We still don't know what causes sudden infant death syndrome, but we have learned that there are certain things that are that mothers and fathers can do to reduce the risk. And one of the easiest and most effective things is to have babies sleep on their back. So the Back to Sleep campaign is to have children up to 6 months of age lying on their back instead of lying face down. In addition, we can help reduce the SIDS rate by having parents not smoke around their infants. When parents smoke around their infants, they're much more likely to have the sudden infant death syndrome response. Also, breastfeeding infants reduces sudden infant death syndrome. And so these are all three things that the Maternal and Child Health Program are trying to get the word to parents of newborns. Back to sleep, don't smoke around the infant, and breastfeed. Breastfeeding has results, positive results on babies well beyond some sudden infant death syndrome. It reduces their number of sick days, which in turn reduces their medical expenses. It provides immunity to infectious diseases because the mother can pass that immunity on in her milk. And mother's milk has also been shown to give children better brain development. So breastfeeding is really important to the health of infants. And on top of that, it allows a working mother to have more days at work if she's able to keep breastfeeding because her baby is less likely to be sick and need to be kept home from child care and kept out of child care. So we have a little campaign going now to educate employers about how being a breastfeeding friendly employer can be good for your business. If you allow mothers to take 15 minutes twice a day to pump their breast milk and have a little refrigerator to store it in, they're likely to have a mother who's at work more often and uses less medical care for herself and her baby, and it reduces your costs as an employer in the long run. This is one of the areas where we're working with the TANF program, saying if you can encourage your welfare-to-work moms, who many of whom are new mothers, to keep breastfeeding even when they go back to work, they're more likely to have fewer sick days and have a healthier infant, and in some ways to feel more bonded and positive about their interactions with their infant even though they're working. So we think breastfeeding is an important part of getting babies off to a good start. We support fluoride again for babies. If they get fluoride drops while the enamel of their teeth is forming, they're much less likely to have decay as younger children.
Madam Chair, I know we talked about fluoride water last time. I have a couple more other questions. Can you tell us when was the last time the initiative or the referral was given statewide for voters' approval?
Senator Yee, Senator Chitub, and Senator Yee, I do have a packet of information for you about fluoride that I would be glad to give you it here in a minute. I don't know if I know the answer to that question, but I do have a staff person who perhaps knows more than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to wait till we go through that packet?
Yes.
That'd be all right?
Uh-huh. You're going to go through this today or?
Yes. I hope to, as soon as we finish this next couple pages, I hope to be able to pick up on questions that were outstanding from our last hearing
mm-hmm.
and provide information on fluoride.
Right. I guess my question is it time to send out another referral for voters' opinion on this issue? Because we are all thinking about preventive measures, and this probably will be an effective preventive measure if it needs voters' approval. And maybe this is the time you can give out education material that this will be effective in preventing tooth decay and help with health of their teeth.
Mm-hmm. It might be. And so when we get to that part of the presentation this afternoon, it might be something we can revisit and discuss
mm-hmm.
through as a
trend. Yes.
Thank you.
Again, we want a safe home environment for preschoolers. One of the issues that exists in this state, for instance, is the issue of lead in homes. Homes that were built before 1970 are likely to have lead paint, and there are many older homes that are not in good repair with flaking and peeling lead paint. Toddlers who ingest lead, whether it's from dust or from actually eating the paint, can have, again, behavioral problems, developmental disabilities, and a slightly lower IQ.
Madam Chair, lead paint. How would you get rid of it? Would you have to tear the walls down or paint over it?
One of the problems sometimes is that when people are remodeling, they sand off their lead paint and put lots of lead dust into the air, and that can be just as dangerous as having the paint there in the first place. So there has to be some advice to the family on, given the condition, or the landlord, given the condition of this house, what's the best thing to do? And painting over it is an acceptable pollution in many cases. There are some cases where we recommend they actually replace parts like window frames, and it may be best to replace those completely rather than try to sand them down. People need to use a vacuum cleaner with filters so that if dust gets into the carpet and into the air, it isn't recirculated by the vacuum cleaner. And they can wipe surfaces to keep dust and lead off of the surfaces. The State Health Division does have a program that was set up, sort of created by the federal government, where we certify people who are experts in how to make homes lead safe. So also someone who's selling a house or someone who has bought an older house and wants to make those repairs can call someone who knows what they're doing and get expert advice. And we certify them. They pay for that process. There's no state general fund money involved, but it's helped to assure that contractors and others who are working with older homes don't inadvertently release lead into the environment. Infant hearing screening is something that you may be hearing about. There's a recognition that if infants are screened very young for whether or not they can hear, that they can start programs as infants that will enable them to have their brain develop and understand speech much better than if they get to be 3 years old before their parents recognize that they don't hear. So infant hearing screening in some states is mandated just the way the newborn metabolic screening is mandated. And we hope that someday that will be the case in Oregon. We think that it's very cost effective in terms of saving money on special education later on if that remediation and help begins when they're little infants instead of when they're much later in life. But right now, infant hearing screening is done in some hospitals and by some pediatricians, but it's not being done universally across the state. But we have been working with a committee of people who are advocates to talk about how we could expand and extend infant hearing.
Thank you. If a child has bad hearing, is that reversible? Can that child be helped if they are born with great hearing loss, or even if it happens when they're a year old or so? Can that be reversed?
Our maternal and child health director is Imelda Dotson. Let me call her to respond.
I wonder if the screening might continue with their death, but does it kind of help them?
For the record, my name is Imelda Dotson with the Oregon Health Division. Madam Chair, Representative Loken, depending upon the nature of the hearing loss, sometimes can be reversed or can be augmented. The whole idea is to identify these children that have severe losses, to also see what kinds of, whether it's hearing aids or what other kind of thing should be intervened at that time so the parents can work with that child just from the beginning, not wait until they're three or four.
Mm-hmm. Does that answer your follow-up? Actually, hearing can be improved then with the hearing aids.
In some cases.
Is that the only way? What else can you do?
Well, depending upon the nature.
My deaf cousin, and he became deaf early years, a patient due to an illness, a severe illness.
Depending upon the nature of what caused the illness or caused the deafness. In some children, if they've had severe hearing infections or ear infections, sometimes they just need to have those treated in order for them to be able to hear, or to have those treated sooner than 2 or 3 years later. So in this case, we're talking about infants at birth, but hearing loss can be along the whole spectrum because children get ear infections.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
One of the very effective ways to work with at-risk families is to use nurse home visiting services. And in fact, public health nurses in every county do Babies First home visiting. Babies First is a program where a nurse visits a family that has a child at risk either because of a physical health condition or a social condition. Babies that are born, for instance, with a birth defect or a chronic disabling condition or a chronic illness will get a visit from a public health nurse who's working with the OHSU program and the Child Development Resource Center. We call that program Cocoon, but in fact they're done by the same nurses who do the Babies First program, and they're virtually transparent to the family whether they're in Babies First or Cocoon. But the public health nurse is able to work with the pregnant woman to try to get the baby born healthy, and then she's able to stay with that young baby and mother helping the mother with whatever issues arise for her, whether it's normal breastfeeding and supporting that, or helping the mother be sure she gets immunizations, or deals with issues in her own life, whether that's mental illness or alcohol and drug abuse. Public health nurses can be very effective in working with very troubled families. Currently, the state general fund that's working on Babies First is under $1 million for the biennium. But counties have put their own money into this Babies First home visiting program and supplemented that in many counties, so that there's more nurse visiting going on. In fact, we think there are about 23,000 home visits that were made with public health nurses. And they're so flexible. They can work across the whole spectrum, whether it's working with a family with lead or working with a family with a deaf child, working with a family that's homeless or working with a family that's trying to get access to immunization. So they're a very flexible kind of way of supporting maternal and child health.
So you visit 23,000 infants in a year?
23,000 visits.
22,000 visits. Okay, so what portion of the infants that are born are you actually able to reach?
We're visiting about 9,000 individuals. There's about 43,000 babies born in Oregon every year. But some of our 9,000 people that we're visiting are children that are older than infants. They may be 1 year old or 2 years old. In general, we know that we don't have enough nurse home visits to meet the need. We turn down about 30% of the referrals that we get from obstetricians, hospital nurses, and other people who are involved with children. So we have to triage, the counties have to triage the home visits very closely because they simply don't have enough money. They are able to bill the Oregon Health Plan for certain types of visits for patients when they're eligible, but not all of their patients have Oregon Health Plan, obviously. Some of them have private insurance, which doesn't pay, or no insurance, or the conditions and things we're providing aren't covered by the health insurance plan.
Yeah. I have a question about this, simply because of the, it sounds like it is a different program than Health Start. But I would like to know, how is it that a baby is visited? Where do you, for what reason would an obstetrician or a nurse or whatever refer you? It sounds like part of what you said already is with the birth defects and some things that happen when this child is born. What are the other reasons for this visitation?
Well, we can visit when it appears that the family is, or the mother and baby are going to be struggling significantly with just having a healthy, normal home. So, for instance, if the mother is very young, we have referrals on teen mothers, especially teenagers who aren't living at home. They particularly are going to need some kind of oversight and support and help. If there's been obvious problems in the family. For instance, perhaps the family suddenly been evicted from their home. We have nurses who go out and make visits on families that are living in cars all the time, families that are living in tents, families that are in the state park. So if the hospital nurse finds out that the mother is taking her newborn home to a shelter or home to the Salvation Army, she may call for public health nurse visit. If the mother has had previous problems, for instance, has a history of chronic and persistent mental illness, and perhaps may have even had children removed from her home in the past, but is not an open case to SCF. And we work very closely with SCF on these kind of high-risk families where they think the mother is going to be able to handle this, but they want to be sure there's some support there. The public health nurse may be called and asked to go in and do teaching and observation and in some ways be a support. And then if the nurse sees that the situation is not working out, she's a mandatory reporter to call SCF and say that we think there's a case that needs your investigation. So nurses are more the supportive side of trying to keep children safe in a very high-risk situation. But there can be a whole constellation of factors, and you just mentioned a few of them yourself, around babies that are born very premature. Some shall have premature multiple births. Often multiples are born very tiny. And again, the family may need some special support, especially if they're very low income. They may be looking at triplets and no money. How are we going to take care of them?
In the counties, I realize that not all the counties have Healthy Start, but in those counties that have Healthy Start, do you know if there's coordination between the two entities so that we are not duplicating and what? Because it does sound a little bit more severe, the reason for these children that are being visited by public health nurses, defects and that kind of thing. Although some of the things that you stated sounded to me also like they could be the Healthy Start mode. On the other hand, Healthy Start is the first birth. This doesn't seem to be limited to that either, but certainly we want our resources to go as far as we possibly can have them go, and if there's a way to coordinate in any county that has the Healthy Start, we really should make an effort to do that.
Chair Futab and committee members, we completely agree with you. I think that the programs have some potential for seeing some of the same families, though that you're correct that there are some differences too. And in the counties where there are a number of counties where there's an outstanding coordination process going on, where the programs are housed together in the same place, where the public health nurses provide some backup and professional supervision to the Healthy Start home visitors. In other places, they meet together regularly to do case conferencing and decide who should see which family. There are some counties where I think the cooperation could be improved, and that's been part of the focus of this planning process that's been going on among state agencies since last summer, where we've been talking about how we could ensure that every place that has a program has a simple, easy entry to services, so families and nurse doctors don't have to figure out what's the right number to call, and then coordination across cases, so that if the Healthy Start visitor finds someone who needs public health work or vice versa, that it's easy to bring the other part of the resource into the family. And I don't think that they are duplications in the sense that I know, but neither program are able to see all the families that are referred to them and that have at-risk conditions. And additionally, I think that there are some differences in what the program goals are. Generally, the health divisions, the health departments, Babies First program sees families many fewer times than Healthy Start. We average about 3 visits per family, and that's partly because we have so many fewer resources. You can imagine with only $500,000 a year to cover the whole state, we're not able to stick with families for the length of time that we would like. And I think sometimes we do not give families enough support to make all the difference that we could. But I do think nurse home visiting is an important part of public health and one of the ways we can reach people with all kinds of maternal and child health support.
Just to follow up on that a minute, you said that you're not able to accept about 30% of the calls. In those counties where there is a Healthy Start, would some of those families that you can't see personally, would they be told that Healthy Start is available so they could seek it if they wanted to?
Well, in counties where there's good coordination, we would actually trade referrals with Healthy Start. Okay, this is a family we can't see. Maybe you could evaluate them and do your screen and see if you would be able to see them. Or we would have gone out and done a screen and said, this is not the family we're going to be able to see, but we urgently want you to be able to stay with them. So with good coordination, it shouldn't be up to the families to have to do that. We should be able to offer them something.
Thank you.
And we just completed some work with families around what did they get out of the Babies First home visiting program. I find a tremendous enthusiasm by families for the nurse in her role as a teacher and support person. And they especially like when she comes out and teaches them about child development. So there's a lot of acceptance by mothers of a public health nurse. so when we get these little kids to kindergarten, before the pre-K years, we are still working on many of the same issues. We want to have immunizations for kids, and the immunization schedule is getting more complex and more lengthy. We're now able to vaccinate children against chickenpox and measles, mumps, rubella, rotavirus. There's a lot of different diseases we can prevent. Dental health is still important. This is an area where we're starting to get kids' teeth, get them visiting a dentist if possible. Injury prevention is very important here. We know that child car seats are important for safe vehicles, and yet so many car seats are installed improperly or aren't used properly. And even when kids outgrow their car seats, then they need to be in booster seats for a while until they weigh enough to be facing seat belts. We're also working on injury prevention around things like drowning prevention, smoke detectors, bicycle helmets, educating parents about how to child-proof their home. So people who come into our WIC programs or well-child clinics may get pamphlets about how you can make your home safe for kids or how to use your car seat safely. And safe and healthy child care is another issue. We have many, many parents of young children who are in the workforce now, and children spend a good part of their day in child care. Many of them are in family daycare homes where the providers very much want to give quality care but may need some help and support around how to work with issues of communicable disease, how to make their home safe, what kinds of education and training they may need, whether it's infant CPR or first aid for children. And we do try to work with the employment development child care program around how to do education and programs for safe and healthy child care. And this is an area we would love to do a lot more in. We think that our natural role as teachers and preventers and collaborators would be perfect match with people who are involved in providing daycare.
Thank you. Thank you. I wonder if you could just quickly comment about the bicycle helmet program, and is there anything that you, the division, has done to study the effectiveness of that and compliance, things like that?
Thank you, Senator Sita. I'd love to show that. Yes, it's, after the bicycle helmet bill was passed, the health division has tried to do education about what the bicycle helmet requirements are, especially to law enforcement. We've tried to enlist law enforcement as educators so that when they see kids who aren't riding with helmets, they'll stop and tell them about the law, not ticket them necessarily. And we've done videotapes that are part of the training programs for law enforcement across the state. We've also have evaluated this by looking at death certificates and information from our trauma registry. And we saw a real drop-off in deaths of young people wearing bicycle helmets in the 3 years since bicycle helmet law was passed, which was the time we studied it. And I could get you the exact data. I hesitate to quote it to you now, but we have seen a real decline in injuries and in childhood fatality.
Just an observation. I know in my area it looks like the little kids, you know, the elementary kids are mostly complying. By the time they get to middle school and high school, you don't see that many just running around the neighborhood wearing bicycle helmets. So,
well, that is, I think it does, you know, just having the law isn't enough. It does take a constant effort. And there, we are joined by a lot of other partners in this. I believe it was Legacy Hospital who just recently had a wonderful child health safety day where they sold bicycle helmets for $5 each and had thousands of, over the years, they will reach thousands of parents about how you will properly adjust and wear a bicycle helmet. And there's a lot of advocacy that's still going on in the EMS community around helmets. The health division's had a little grant for 3 years to try to educate about bicycle helmets, and our little federal grant expired, so we don't have a separate activity or separate program on it, but we do continue to believe it's important.
Thank you.
I bought my 5-year-old grandson a bicycle helmet, and he was so thrilled he wore it to bed.
He falls out of bed every day.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, moving on to healthy kids make better students. Now, page 38, we say that on one side, we do have some risky behaviors, some negative choices, and societal challenges that are facing our students today. We think that public health promotes healthy behaviors and positive choices. And on the next slide, we show you some of the problems that are facing students today.
Madam Chair, just wonder on this page 38, does this imply that rain is a negative choice or risky behavior and sun is good? It's over. We're all in deep trouble.
I'd say so. Calm down.
Well, we have a little clock here showing that as the clock turns, there are some health problems in Oregon students. And I also brought you a poster. This is has some of the same information. It says, let's face the facts, healthy kids make better students. In Oregon, every 96 minutes, a child is born to a teen mother. Obesity affects 1 in 10 children under age 5. They're not off to a good start in their obesity profile. Each day, 30 children in Oregon start smoking. 1 in 3 high school students report having drank 5 or more drinks in a row in the previous year. Every 12 days, a child in Oregon commits suicide. Every 12 months, 1 in 4 high school students has been in a physical fight. In other words, when we say, in the past year, have you been in a physical fight? Yes, 1 in 12 have. And 1 in 5 high school students report having carried a weapon to school in the past year. Not necessarily to attack someone, perhaps in self-defense. But nonetheless, we have some troubling statistics about health in our students.
Now, I'm sure, and a weapon, I think, is defined as not just gun, knife, mm-hmm. but mace, brass knuckles. Mm-hmm. Those types of things are considered weapons. Mm-hmm.
So, we want to be countering some of these negative statistics. And we want to be working with kids and schools and parents and communities to help kids make healthy choices in the face of their challenges. And if you turn to page 40, you see some of the programs and initiatives that the Health Division is working on to try to create healthier students. We have a youth suicide prevention program. Thanks to the legislature last session, the 97 legislature passed a statute with help from Senator Fisher, who I believe was the sponsor of the bill, to create a position in the Health Division called the Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator. And we have just been holding forums around the state. We're having 12 forums this spring to work with communities on what would be the plan for our state to try to reduce youth suicide in the state. And it's very emotional and wrenching hearings when you talk to parents who have survived the loss of their child. And there's a lot of passion in the communities to try to do more around mental health, drug and alcohol, recognizing the signs of suicide and helping people who work with youth know what to do when they see a child who looks like they're in trouble.
Madam Chair, Representative, you were going to speak, I think.
Go ahead.
In these hearings, Dan, what have you learned? Have you learned ways to cope with this, and are we putting those into action?
Results. Yes. Well, the goal of our forums that we're having is to do a statewide plan on how to reduce youth suicide. And we know some of what needs to be in the plan. We think we need to do more to be sure that young people have access to mental health services, especially on a crisis basis. We know that we need to do more to help school personnel recognize and cope with kids. Often people will know that a child was suicidal, but the process of getting them help doesn't happen fast enough. Mm-hmm. There's things that communities can do where there has been a suicide to try to prevent more copycat suicides, which unfortunately some communities have experienced not one loss, but multiple losses. It's almost like a infection that gets started. We are doing some special work with the Native American tribes. The tribes have a very high suicide rate, in part reflecting some of the issues around alcohol use. And we're
the tribes are starting some of their own campaign around how to save their youth. It's a little too soon for me to tell you all the elements of the plan, but I really would love to send you the statewide plan when it's finished later this spring.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll set out some specific things, but we are working with mental health, schools, drug and alcohol, and communities.
I have a quick question. Hopefully somebody can answer it. How many teens do we have in Oregon? I mean, because I'm 39, you name a number of things by the spot. Do we have the number of teens that there are?
Total teens in the state? Well, let's say there's about 40,000 children in each age block. If you consider teens to be 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, it would be about 200,000 teens.
200,000. You tell me what you consider a teen. These are your statistics. That's what I want to know.
Yeah. I'm not sure in this chart. Do we know what we're considering teen in this chart? Usually under the age of 17.
From 14 to 17.
Yeah. We have had some suicides in Oregon that are younger than 12. We've had some very young children actually kill themselves. So I believe the suicide number probably represents everything under 17.
Okay, and everything under 17 is 200,000?
No, it would be more than that. Would you like the rate of teen? Are you getting that? What is the rate at which young people kill themselves?
I'm trying to do some math here to tell me some things. And that's why I need to know how many teenagers are in this pool of teens that we're saying every 2.5 minutes a teen uses drugs.
Oh, okay.
Every 63 minutes, a teen becomes pregnant.
Okay.
Every 48 minutes. So in order for me to do the math on some of this, I need to know what number we're talking about.
Let me get you those exact numbers.
Okay.
What we did was take rates and then translate them into numbers for you. So the rates may vary somewhat between the pools may vary somewhat between these different clocks. There may be a different number for the teenage for suicide, for instance, than for using drugs or alcohol. But I can definitely tell you what each one is based on, and then it can tell you the total. Would you like also the total number in each year?
Yeah.
That sounds like maybe where you were headed.
Well, and Madam Chair, if she's going to compile information, I think it'd be really helpful for us to have the source, because I think you've got the source of these things, and some of them are Oregon data, and some were extrapolated. Or anyway, give us the source.
I will give you the source. Absolutely.
Thank you.
These on this chart are all Oregon data, and so they are sources mostly from within the health division, where we have either vital statistics or behavior risk. Let's see, we were talking about suicide prevention. We also are, of course, are very interested in tobacco prevention, in HIV prevention.
That's what I thought.
We're interested in health education and working with schools and the Department of Education on what are good curriculums that may be useful for kids to help them grow up healthy. We support physical education in the schools. And we are interested in violence prevention. Violence is a huge health problem in many schools. We've also talked a little bit about the abstinence education program. Students today aren't ready for sex, and that's an important part of choosing healthy and positive behaviors. Turning the page, we believe that healthy adolescents become independent, productive adults.
Depending upon what your question is.
My question is on page 40. Did you give us some information about how much are we spending on abstinence education for the STARS program for this biennium compared to next biennium, and how many more students are we reaching in the next biennium, and how many do we teach now?
I do have quite a bit of information on STARS, and let me just close out maternal and child health, and I'll go right to STARS and start talking about it. The next line is, we think that healthy adolescents become independent, productive adults. And that's really what we're after with our education system, right? We want kids to come out and end at 12th grade ready to assume their place as responsible adults who will be able to work and contribute to society. And we think all of the things we've been talking about contribute to that goal. If kids are drinking and drugging or dropping out or come to school unable to learn, leave school because they are ill or pregnant, you won't end up with the real product that we want out of our education system. And I believe that in order to make the grade, turn the page to 42, making the grade, getting better educational outcomes, we want to support maternal, child, and adolescent health. And I hope this has been helpful in showing how public health is a complement to our goals for children, an important part of our goals for young people. That concludes my real presentation on the Health Division budget, and I'd be happy to go now to talking about specifically more about STARS, if that would be what you'd like to hear.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes? We have a packet handout about STARS for you. And I'd like to show you what I'm giving you. A lot of different materials in this package. Let me summarize it. STARS is an abstinence-only education program aimed at 6th or 7th graders, depending on the community's choice. It's a program that's a week-long curriculum. There are 5 sessions. And the curriculum is actually taught by teen leaders. So we recruit high school students.
Representative,
You said it was a week-long curriculum. It's just 1 hour a day, though. It isn't.
That's right.
It is
not 8 hours a day.
Excuse
me. There are 5 lessons in the STARS program, which usually are done in a week. Some schools have done them over several weeks.
Madam Chair, I thought it was a 5-week program.
A minute.
Once a week.
Be sure my STARS expert comes up and sits with me. David Blaine is the director of the STARS program, and it's the maternal and child and adolescent health specialist. David, did I misstate the STARS?
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm David Lane, the adolescent health manager. Madam Chair, Senator V, you are correct. It's reversed. More often done over 5 weeks, 1 hour a day. But in some schools, it is compressed, depending on their schedule.
So is it 5 hours?
Correct. It's five hours. And it depends, again, on the school schedule. Sometimes the school schedule has 55 minutes. Sometimes it has, an hour and 5 minutes. But it's about an hour 5 times, usually over a 5-week period.
Thank you. A key thing that distinguishes STARS is the use of teen leaders or teen mentors. An important part of the program is training the teens, usually juniors or seniors in high school, to go to the middle schools and the junior highs and be exemplary role models while they're teaching kids refusal skills. STARS is an abstinence-only program. It's a clear, consistent, unambivalent, unequivocal message that it's better for kids not to have sex and that you can learn how to refuse things that are not good for you, including sex, by practicing certain skills. And the curriculum does talk with kids about why it's best to wait and their reasons for waiting, but it also is a very skills-based, action-oriented curriculum, which aims to get kids to recognize situations where they could be pressured into doing the wrong thing or could put themselves at risk and to stay out of those situations and teaches them how to say no firmly and unequivocally.
Eleanor, abstinence only?
Abstinence only.
Will you define that?
Senator Chief Heaven, committee members, the program does not teach or talk about contraception.
Safe sex?
No, it does not. this is not to talk about sex.
Senator Kutub, the program specifically focuses on abstinence only, and questions like that that may come up from the kids are referred out. So the teenagers are taught how to not answer that question. So it doesn't mention safe sex at all, doesn't talk about contraceptive access, doesn't define those things for kids. Specifically talks about all the many positive reasons why kids should wait and not have sex, why kids should wait till marriage, why kids should wait till they go to school. If the whole focus is on abstinence.
Do you have any explanation for what seems to be a conflict between this information and what we got last year, or last week, I guess it was, from where was it then?
Senator Kutub and Senator Shields, a lot of what we heard during the public testimony from the four invited testifiers was information that we really agreed with and supported. And we are somewhat surprised at why that was presented as if it was in opposition to the STARS program. We do think that the STARS program is a consistent, clear, concise, abstinence-only program. We do think it's important to involve parents. And one of the documents you got is our little STARS parental involvement guide. We agree that involving communities is important and is part of this our efforts around supporting abstinence. We have changed our curriculum to increase the focus on abstinence until marriage, and I believe that was pointed out by several of the people who testified that the curriculum has evolved, and that represents in part some of our recognition and change of philosophy and attempt to more strongly meet the federal guidelines. I do want to point out that our program does meet the federal guidelines, and I've included a letter from the Department of Health and Human Services which describes those guidelines and summarizes what it is we have to do.
Except that, Eleanor, the Health and Human Services is saying it needs it, but the Congress is saying that the Health and Human Services is not checking closely enough with many other programs around the United States, around the nation. And I think, Senator Shields, that's where you probably got the idea that the testimony last week regarding STARS, it wasn't so much regarding STARS. There was one person who talked about serving as a STARS instructor and was actually later asked not to serve or to go and be a state employee in order to do it. And there were some things actually with the guidelines from Congress that show that really STARS is skirting around the corners for several things that the Congress does list as the 10 criteria in order to have to come under the Title V. But I think the point of the testimony last week was that we need to allow other programs besides STARS that are successful and abstinence only be funded even under the Title V. So I don't think that it was so contradictory. I think that what it did was point out some of the areas that those who are involved in the abstinence education coalition feel are skirting really the federal requirements. And that is, while U.S. Health Department is saying that we need it, they're saying that of other states, and Congress is saying the Health Department, the U.S. Health Department, is not being careful enough to look at programs in this nation that are not following the 10 guidelines that were passed by the House and the Senate, the U.S. Congress, and were signed into law. So that is the issue. And, you know, that the Health Division believes that they're following the criteria because they have information from the U.S. Health Division, but we are continuing to communicate with Congress and Congress with the Health Division, the U.S. Health Division. So our Health Division, we've made them aware what our viewpoint is on it. And when I say ours, I happen to be on that coalition. And so this is just an effort to also make it public to other legislators that we have looked into this, and that we should watch it, have oversight.
Madam Chair, just as one who was not involved as heavily as you, but one who was trying to listen attentively in the testimony, I felt it sounded like there was some contradiction. I appreciate the clarification both from you and from the Health Commission.
Well, continuing, Mr. Kudrow and committee members, we do think that SARS is doing a good job of reaching young people. Oregon is one of the few states that has a program that is trying to reach 100% of kids in middle school. And we have done an evaluation, which was released in October of 1998, and the executive summary of the evaluation is in your packet. The evaluation was done with support from the Oregon Health Policy Institute and involved telephones, calls, and talking with students in 13 counties, 767 middle school students, 201 team leaders, and 25 adult facilitators responded. The highlights from the middle students' responses included the fact that 70% indicated that STARS helped help them to abstain from sex until they were older. 68% said STARS refusal skills helped them say no to situations not right for them. And we were delighted to see that 38% reported using the STARS skills to say no to tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs. So we hope that some of these refusal skills and the practice that kids get in refusal skills will translate across a variety of threats to their health. So even though this is the program is quite explicit about what we're talking about in terms of refusal skills, knowing how to say no and mean it can help kids in other settings. We also feel that the STARS is helping the team leaders.
Before you go on, just let me point out one of the things, the highlights in the middle school student responses. Number one is 70% indicated that STARS helped them to abstain from sex until older. And as we pointed out last week, the Title V money is to go to programs that teach students to abstain from sex until married. Now, some folks might think that is a value judgment, and if they do, fine. But that's what the law says. And so this does say that they're waiting until they're older. This is middle school. Just how much older are they waiting until? You know, that would be the question. And so I don't want to belabor this, but I did want to point out that if we talk about the success, we need to look at the semantics. And Congress also, we're really teaching STARS to a younger age than Title V says that we should be teaching it. They're saying it should be taught to a little bit older age. So. I read this statement and.
Mm-hmm. Senator Kudrow, that's a good point, and I think that this evaluation is an ongoing process, and like the curriculum, what you bring up is a need for us to ask the question a little differently next time, and maybe give kids, you know, options to the way to marriage, so that's, mm-hmm. that's certainly something we can look into.
Good. And I appreciate your help, Doctor, for listening, because it's clear in the curriculum that our conversations with the coalition, with you, have resulted in some good. So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And, Madam Chair, actually, it would be very interesting to know both of those issues. I mean, there is some success with the 70% that indicates that abstinence until they're older is achieved. That would be one percentage figure, and how many of those, that, a subset of that would be many abstain from marriage. I mean, mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. obviously going to be a large differential, but both represent progress from before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the important issues here is how do you evaluate this kind of a program? And certainly, sixth and seventh grades are not peak years for kids actually having babies. So we think that if this program is making a difference, as these middle schoolers get older and move into the years when we have teen pregnancy, that's when we should start seeing a decrease in teen pregnancy. Our intention in targeting this program to this age is to get kids before they start being sexually active. so that they'll make, before they're involved in that kind of activity, they will make a commitment to themselves and to their peer group and to their parents that they aren't going to have sex. And we would be very interested in being able to provide more abstinence education and more abstinence support for kids throughout school. We absolutely think that there needs to be continuing curriculum presentations, and we are in the process of working on whether there could be a booster session for eighth graders. But we would be very interested and want to do more for kids all the way through high school. We do think that the teen leader program is affecting the climate in high schools. We trained 2,000 teen leaders this last year, and they are helping to make abstinence a popular, visible, viable option in their high schools. And we saw that in our youth behavior risk survey recently, where we saw an increase for the first time in a long time in the percentage of kids who had not had sex. And we also saw an increase in the number of kids who said that they would tell their friends to wait. And a variety of questions where our youth behavior risk survey indicated that abstinence is becoming a more of a, even more of a important part of high school life. And that's one of our goals, is we have the goal with high school for young kids to know everybody doesn't do it. The great majority of your peers are not doing this. The norm is not to have sex. And that's some of the same kind of thing that's happening with the high school mentors.
Eleanor, I just, in looking at the highlights from what middle school responses were included, and then, as Senator Shields said, dividing up, wait until later in what age, and until marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you ask a middle school student that, one, you know, if they haven't abstained already and aren't planning to, are planning to continue to abstain, that's fine. How old are they going to abstain until, or are they going to abstain until
mm-hmm.
marriage? These are pretty young students
right.
to be answering
right.
this question.
Yeah, it is.
And you couldn't divide it
sure,
because they're not going to be getting married real soon. But I do think that it is true that if you make the norm abstinence,
mm-hmm.
you will have, and especially with the peers,
mm-hmm.
you will have that the help that it takes for your peers to help you come along and think that it is the norm, and they don't have to be either saying they are having sex or have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is a good value to tell them that they should wait until sex, for sex until marriage.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't possibly really answer that.
Right.
They say they're promising not to.
I guess my point would be that right now it's obviously too early to collect much data. The program hasn't been around that long, but it would be very useful in evaluating this program if, as you finally, after several years, have people that in their 20s that went through this program to see what kind
mm-hmm.
of difference it really did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you can ask the kind of questions I was talking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like, well, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman. I think that when we teach abstinence in schools, it is not just for teen pregnancy prevention, but I think we're also teaching them values that they need to be responsible for their behavior and they need to be accountable for their behavior. So I think it's only right to say until marriage rather than older. Otherwise, it's not consistent with what we are teaching them. So I wish the older would be changed to marriage, not only to be consistent with what the federal requirement says, but also to be consistent with our teaching values to the students. But I have another question,
okay.
Madam Chair. When you say we teach 2,000 team leaders, how many students are we reaching? How many junior high school students? Or is it elementary school students now? Are we reaching?
Senator Kutub and Senator Yee,
mm-hmm.
We began the program in 1997, and at that point, in 1997, we taught 17,000 middle school students. In 1998, we taught 28,000 middle school students. This year, 1999, when we end the year, we estimate that we will have taught 32,000 middle students. And our goal for the next biennium is to reach all 43,000 middle school students in the state. So we've been slowly, not all that slowly, we've actually been rather rapidly ramping up the number of students who are reached. And the key thing that made that possible was the federal abstinence grant, which became available in the last biennium. And that, together with the state's budget allocation, has enabled us to reach this many kids. You asked about the budget, and I did want to tell you a little bit about the budget. We have allocation from the federal government.
Chair.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Page I'm referring to when you talk about
what page?
Yeah.
It's in your pamphlet, and it looks like this. It's in your pocket.
You have a page number.
Oh.
Here.
It's not numbered. Okay, great. So this does include a summary of the state and federal funds and the allocation per student. The cost does range rather quite a lot, actually, from some counties and school districts that are doing this for $9 a student to one district that's costing $102 per student. And the range in cost is due in part to how the school and how the program is actually organized. If the school, for instance, pays the team facilitators for their work, buys some pizza, buys all the kids in the school STARS shirts that say STARS, has to transport their kids for training and perhaps even transport their high school team leaders and perhaps have their team leaders spend the night, pays their adult facilitator as a teacher, so on, they can increase the cost quite a bit. Alternatively, if they don't have to do any transportation, if they can have no frills for the students, and if their team leaders are strictly volunteers, they can do it for less cost per student. But in any case, we think the average is about $50 a student. And the state does not provide all of that money. There's a significant number of private partners who are also involved in STARS. And I want to call your attention to the summary of private partners and the contributions that are being made to the STARS program.
Madam Chair,
it looks like this.
Before she goes on to that next thing, I wanted to ask her a couple questions about the cost. Is this the state allocation per student, or is this the total cost of the program?
Madam Chair, Representative Roth, that's the state allocation, because in the cost for student totals varies greatly in counties depending on what sort of things they do to augment the program, like Eleanor was talking about.
And Madam Chair, so on the bottom of this page it says the cost range lane is $9 to $102. Would that end up to be about the total cost that you could count?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ross, the state tries to give a consistent allocation to the schools, but some schools have been able to augment this more than others through community fundraising and so on. In addition, we've seen that over $750,000 has been given to the STARS program by the private sector, and we listed some of the business donors who have supported STARS. It's quite an impressive list, ranging from Regents Blue Cross to PG Enron. And we think one reason people have been willing to support the STARS program is because it is a curriculum that was previously certified by the Centers for Disease Control, by CDC, as being an effective abstinence curriculum. It was evaluated very rigorously when it was developed in Atlanta, Georgia. And in addition, we've made a commitment at the state level to evaluate the curriculum and to keep trying to improve it. And we've also made a commitment to standardize the training. So our team leaders all use an identical curriculum, and they all are trained by professional trainers. We have regional training sessions, so all the kids don't have to come to Portland. that we ensure that they all have a standard process to follow. And I think that's given the private sector some encouragement that they'll be delivering, they'll be supporting a quality program that has strong standards and is always delivered consistently, and that we will evaluate it and make changes, and that we are committed to building on this curriculum and this program. This is really different from other states.
Don't you? I would submit that there's another reason for its reception among the corporate community, and that's the advocacy of the First Lady. I wonder if you could describe how much you emphasize that, or what role that plays in the presentation of the program to both sponsors and to students.
Senator Chutab and Representative Strobeck, the state health division has not done private fundraising, so we are not emphasizing the First Lady's role so much as she herself is doing private fundraising and emphasizing her commitment to the program. It's true that she has traveled to communities and held meetings with school districts and elected local officials and talked about the STARS program. And I think that has helped STARS to be embraced by so many communities. I think that it's fairly remarkable, given the amount of controversy that education around sex can generate, to have so many schools and counties and communities embracing this program. And it's true that an abstinence-only curriculum is less controversial than some other kinds of curriculum, but we, I think, as a state, have been remarkably fortunate in having that kind of support for a uniform effort. And I'm sure part of it is due to the First Lady's talking to communities about why she thinks this is a good program and why she supports it.
Is this one of your booklets?
Yes.
It's part of the packet. It has right here on the front, STARS Foundation Chair and Kit Hubbard, Executive Director. So I think that is a pretty clear tie.
Well, it does say that they can contact either source for additional information.
Okay.
No, I don't mean to say we're hiding that. We think this is an important partnership for the program. And I'm sure you're correct that business is influenced by her involvement.
I've been to a presentation at which she solicited corporate sponsorship and was the primary presenter.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Just for Representative Strobeck's information, the reason we have so much schools joining this program is because legislature passed legislation to encourage participation in this program. I think it's called Grady Memorial Program, but then later it was changed to START. But legislation was passed to encourage school participation, and funding was provided, and that's how it got started, with $250,000 general fund.
Mm-hmm.
The last session, more federal money. Mm-hmm. Was used to match it. And I'm glad we are seeing increased number of participating
people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my only point in raising the issue is I think the presence of the First Lady's involvement with this program and association with it has led to your contributor list here being longer than it would have been had you just gone out on your own as a health division and said, we have an idea which sponsor it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. People are not as inclined to give money to government, even though we're just doing wonderful things. I did say that I thought Oregon was somewhat different than other states, and just as a way of contrast, I wanted to tell you what was happening in Washington. In Washington, they're getting $739,000 of federal funds compared to our $460,000 of federal funds. So they're getting half again as many federal funds as we're getting. They've chosen to spend their money on a statewide one media project and seven schools. So they're going to reach under 10,000 kids with their much larger allocation. We are one of the few states that I think are trying to reach all kids and trying to have a consistent program. I would like to urge the committee to keep STARS as the foundation for abstinence only in our state, and recognize, though, that it is just a foundation, and that if we are able to find additional resources or able to add to this, that the Health Division would very much like to participate in that and would be supportive of that and potentially some of the programs you heard about on Wednesday. However, we do think having a program that reaches all kids in the state that can be evaluated and that can be standardized and delivered in a quality assurance manner is important to the state.
I'm going to just, we need to move on. George needs to give that presentation. I'm going to, as chair, just take the liberty of saying just a couple more things. First of all, the unsolicited letters. I would point out to my colleagues that the first two letters, the first one says that she's learning, he or she, I guess, anyway, they're learning about the dangers of unprotected sex. And then the second letter, which talks about having sex to wait, about saying no to having sex and to wait until you're older. So just in those two letters, we see what these kids' idea about the abstinence part of it is. I could swear I had another thing to say, but we'll come back to it if we need to, and maybe not. But at any rate, I think in order to...
I wonder if we could get the evaluation, because they gave us an executive summary. Is the evaluation available to us?
You mean the entire evaluation?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Is that available?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'd like to give that to you.
I'd appreciate having an opportunity to really do the evaluation.
Okay.
I have to stop talking about fluoride. If you want me to go to fluoride, is that... Or if you want to do something else.
We want to go to George Naughton.
Okay.
To give us the governor's budget. We'll come back to the fee bills another day.
How about if I leave you the packet of information on fluoride and also the packet of information responding to other questions you raised, and then you can talk to me.
Great. Yes. I'm sorry.
Not at all. We're close.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am George Naughton with the Department of Administrative Services. We have about 12 minutes left, and I think barring a whole lot of questions, I should be able to roll through this fairly.
All right, so we'll try to hold our questions until the end, and if there's time, we'll do it, and if not, you can see George afterwards.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Overall, this budget has increased by about 9.1% from the legislatively approved level, and in a real macro sense, that increase comes from two different things. The first one is that we have an increase in non-limited funding for our women's, infants, and children's food program. That's money that comes from the feds, or we get as rebates from infant formula companies. That equated out to be about a $9 million increase, roughly. The other major one was that the feds approved a waiver for us for family planning services that brought in about $24 million in federal funds for many of the things we've been talking about already. That's a 9-to-1 match. So those are the primary things that have changed this budget in a large sense. We did start with a general fund budget of $24.5 million, 260.3 total funds. And I'm going to turn to the second page of the presentation. I'm going to primarily skip the emergency board and current service level stuff. We have a lot of federal revenue changes back and forth. This agency has a lot of federal grants that come in that phase in and phase out. So there's a lot of times are a wash for the agency. Where I want to start is on the policy packages with package 090. That is, as you've seen in the other Department of Human Resource budgets, where the governor made a lot of adjustments up and down. The first major one you see there is the family planning waiver. It was a 9-to-1 federal match with a net increase for this budget of about $16.8 million total funds. I mean, again, primarily from the, well, exclusively from federal funds almost. We had an adjustment for a chemical stockpile program. That's the burn over in Unicella County that the federal government's going to do for that storage facility over there. We have added a person to help coordinate the public health needs of that region. One of the reductions that we took in this agency was we reduced by 7% the amount of money going to counties for flexible child health grants. That was about $200,000. And it was not that we do not think these are worthwhile programs. They are very important. This is just one of the reductions we had to take to balance the governor's budget at the time. Again, it was about $200,000 that we reduced these grants by at 7%. We also, as part of the budget process, reduced the inflationary growth rate for the county grants down to, well, you'll see in the other budgets, 2% per year. We made a reduction for HIV/AIDS services. That was actually what happened here was we reduced it within this budget, the health division, but we added it back very much later in the process, so you will see it in the director's office budget. We actually just transferred the funding from this pot to another pot. In the reshoot, you will see that money come back. We will transfer it back to the health division. Services have not changed here. We just had a funding shift, and we'll be back in this budget eventually. The last reduction that you see in package 090 is a services and supply reduction of $485,000. We directed the division to find a way that they could cut their services and supplies across the board, and we will talk about this more when we get into the rebalancing issue. The last page, page 3, is the policy packages that were approved at the governor's recommended level. The first package, 120, is actually a reduction to the budget. It is for HIV services. These were a grant that was eliminated from the federal government. We chose not to backfill this part of the government's recommended budget process, so this is a reduction of $92,000. Package 121 is communicable disease control. This is within the public health lab. We did not have other funds, fee revenue, sufficient to cover the expenses of the program, and we ended up adding $453,000 in general fund so that we could continue the communicable disease testing that we're currently doing for county health departments. Package 122 is this National Environmental Laboratory Accreditation. What we did here is we added $365,000 in fee revenue. And this is actually a very interesting project. It's a joint project with the Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Agriculture, and the Health Division. The federal government has, in essence, created the de facto standard that all environmental laboratories that deal with the federal government must have this federal accreditation. Now, what this package does is that it allows these Oregon businesses to attain that accreditation. So hopefully they'll be able to work with the federal government and not see a change in their workflow. Package 130 is the drinking water operator certification. This was a change at the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA level. We have to make those corresponding changes here. And you'll see the corresponding substantive changes in House Bill 2176. And I think the Health Division at a later date may be able to talk with you about that, and you'll see it probably. Package 131 is the pool and spa licensing program. We have a fee increase there that generates $118,000. The program just is simply not covering its cost, and therefore they have to increase their fee so that it is covering. Package 140 you've talked quite extensively about. It's funding for 7 school-based health centers. We added $1 million general funds to that. The last two packages, the last two that I have bulleted here, package 160, both of these are administrative in nature. Package 160 adds a staff person for the mail center so that they can process their mail. They've had quite an increase there. And then the final one is various position changes where the duties of the positions have changed throughout the department, and they have bumped those up or down. As far as the position changes and the mail center staff, neither of those are going to cost the center any general fund. They come from other funds or federal funds or some other source. The final thing that I've mentioned there at the very bottom is that you will see all of this stuff change when we get into the governor's revised budget and when we get into the reshoot and rebalance, which I think is coming up for the end of this month. Madam Chair, I think that concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Other questions? Eleanor, do you want to just briefly say maybe what's in the packet?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. The blue folder is responses to questions about fluoridation, and we've put in information about How much does it cost to fluoridate water? Does it go through soft drinks and juice? And the answer is yes. That's made with fluoridated water. There's a community fluoridation fact sheet and a budget spreadsheet that shows how much it would cost to fluoridate the water in each community for 1 year. And some additional information on health effects and the American Dental Association's support. So the Health Division would be very glad to talk with you further about fluoridation. We think it's a very cost-effective public health effort. We've also provided you with a packet of information in response to things that were brought up as questions during our hearing. There's some information on the diabetes program, which counties, which 10 counties have projects, and then an attachment that shows what the local diabetes programs are like, what the coalitions are doing, and what kind of activities they're supporting. We also provided some information on clinics, what kinds of clinics do counties operate, and what in each county, how many of the clinics do they have, and what are they doing. So this was brought up in response to whether we had primary care clinics and how many people did they reach and what other kinds of clinics existed. And I believe that summarizes the information that you have.
Okay. Any questions on this?
A couple of quick questions.
Okay.
Eleanor, did you give us information about how much potential savings is there in the future? If we go into fluoridation, say, in the year 2000?
I believe that we did. In general, yes, I think we did. If you let me quote here in the middle, we say that the Centers for Disease Control estimates that a total savings of up to $80 per dollar spent on fluoridation could be realized. We've also tried to create savings for the Oregon Health Plan specifically, because I know that's an area where you actually could capture the savings again. But I'm not sure whether that's in this
period, which is the $80 savings. I mean, is it several years down the line? Or
yes, it is. It is several years down the line. And that is in the material that I gave Ms. Archer from the Centers for Disease Control. And you may all want a copy of that, or just a copy on fluoridation. Do you want me to give them that?
I can. Actually, the copy I have is not very readable because it is a fax.
It's fax. Let me.
So I think a non-fax copy would be in order.
Should I provide the whole report or just the section on fluoride?
Mm-hmm. One more quick question.
Do you want just the section on fluoride, or do you want the whole report?
Well, whole report means what?
I don't like reading the section of all right.
Yes. The big one, I
guess. Yes. Just start with a section.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. Madam Chair, I just want to know, is it detectable in taste? I mean, can you tell it tastes fluoride? Fluoride.
Fluoride. No, you can't. It's not detectable.
It's not right.
If you change the taste of water or change the water. And there's a little chart, I believe you have a little chart, that shows that a number of Oregon communities have naturally occurring fluoride. So it does, and there's some communities in Oregon which have chosen to fluoridate. But it is not making water unattractive except when it's in too high a concentration. And there have been some communities with naturally occurring fluoride that's been too strong, but for the most part, when it's at the right level for saving teeth, there's no detectable.
Okay, with that, thank you very much. We're going to adjourn for today and reconvene tomorrow at 10 o'clock.